So, I threw out the figure 77 books. That may not be accurate. I'd have to double-check the press kit there, but it's something like that, isn't it?
I don't know. Let's see. There have been 44 or 45 87 Precinct Mysteries, 10 of the Matthew Hope novels. That's 55. About 17 Evan Hunter novels. Yeah, it'd be close. And some wild cards in there along the way that don't belong to any specific category or genre. And,
what do you do in your spare time?
What spare time? We travel a lot, my wife and I. We go to somewhat exotic places and enjoy ourselves when I'm not writing.
Where do you go?
Well, in recent years we've been to Africa, India, Papua New Guinea, which was a good one, I tell you. And like that, we've been all over the world. We don't go for very long stretches, you know. I'll finish a book, and we'll go for 2-3 weeks, something like that, and then come back refreshed and get to work again.
But you finish a book a couple times every year.
Well, that's true. We go away a couple times every year.
You must be exceedingly disciplined, though, to be able to do that, because nobody puts a gun at your head and says, Evan, get to work, start to write.
Yeah. Well, that discipline may be a wrong word, because it implies that someone is forcing you to do something. You need discipline. I really enjoy it, and I'll go into that office at 10 in the morning, and 6:30 at night, the phone will ring, and my wife will say, aren't you coming home for dinner? And the time will just have flown by, you know, and I'll just be having such fun in there. Even if it's a difficult day where the writing is coming very hard, it's fun, you know. It's a challenge to get the thing right.
Does it get lonely doing the solitary work at all?
No, I think a writer chooses to be a writer because of the solitude. He wants to be alone with the page or the screen, as the case is now. I never feel lonely. I feel alone sometimes, but never lonely, because when I'm writing, there are all these characters I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. And I'm never in that room. I'm always someplace else. You know, I'm either in the tropics or in the North Pole or in a battlefield or in a woman's head or, you know, yanking a sword from a scabbard. There are 100 things that go on during the day and 100 different people that I'm dealing with. So I never feel lonely.
Of course, you seem like a very gregarious person. Do you have a lot of friends? For example, you finish a day's worth of work and go out in the evening and things like weekends?
Yeah, we normally, like my wife and I will, we live alone now. You know, my daughter's grown, my sons are grown, and so we'll go out a lot to dinner, or we'll just eat dinner at home alone. When we go out, we normally go out with friends, other writers, but people who aren't writers. It's a pretty good life, I think.
Oh, I would think so. So I used the term discipline, and you said you didn't like that term because it sounded like somebody was forcing you. But
yeah.
In a way, you do have to force yourself, don't you?
No.
You don't have to?
I look forward to getting up in the morning and going to work there and starting to work. In fact, I have my studio is some 30 yards or so from the house, and we deliberately chose this house because there was a workplace separate from the house. Otherwise, the temptation would be to go do the work again, you know, finish dinner and wander over and say, gee, that scene is bothering me. I think I'll work on it until I get it right. But with the studio away from the house, and you get the sense that you can lock the door and go home and relax, you know, and have a good dinner and watch some television or read some magazines or read a good book.
Well, of course, I work as you can see, a busy newsroom, and I have to be here at a specific time, and I have a specific newscast I have to work on. But the times that I work at home, on the limited amount of writing that I've been able to do, I find myself frequently distracted, particularly by the kitchen. You know, the refrigerator is there, and then I have other books. You know, I have a stack of books there that I should read, and then there'll be the stereo, and maybe I ought to turn on the television for a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wonder that the idea of a studio, a place where there are just four walls and you're away from all these temptations, might be a good one.
Yeah, when I first began writing, I had three small sons growing up in the house, you know, and this was preschool age when I was writing, and they would come barging into. I used to work in the master bedroom of the house. Master bedroom makes it sound like a grand room. It was a tiny little room in the development house we had on Long Island at the time. And my sons would barge in at any moment, and I got used to working with any kind of distraction or whatever might happen with young boys running around. And but once I recognized that I could freelance and I had enough money to enable to myself to write full time, I always took another place to write away from the house. So that I would be away from it and could leave it there at the end of the day, put it out of my mind. And it's a good way to do it because you come back to it fresh in the morning, you know, and you'll look at what you wrote the day before and study that page and make your corrections and look through the whole thing, 10 pages, whatever it is, 8 pages. And you'll feel refreshed and ready to move on to the next section, whatever that may be.
Sounds like a very professional approach, like going to a 9-to-5 job in a way.
Yeah, almost. Almost as if I had an honest job.
I can't think of anything more honest or better than being a writer. Now, Mary, this is, how many Matthew Hope?
10. This is number 10.
This is the 10th.
It's the first one in which he takes a case to court, actually. And the other ones, he served almost as a pseudo private eye amateur detective, but in this one, he takes a case to court. He's a lawyer, you know, and he tries the case.
Now, all of the Matthew Hope novels have names and fairy tales.
Yeah. That was the Matthew Hope series, unlike the 87 Precinct novels. When I started the 87 Precinct novels, I knew it was going to be a series because I had a contract for 3 books, and I knew it was going to be a series. And all the characters were in place from book one. You know, new ones have been brought in over the years, but the nucleus of the squadron, they were there from minute one. And the repertory company was in place. With the first of these novels, it wasn't even supposed to be a crime novel. The book, it was supposed to be a so-called serious Evan Hunter novel, a mainstream novel, called The Scene of the Crime. And it was supposed to be about divorce and... the metaphor was a brutal crime is committed and the guy has been divorced and remarried and like that. Well, it didn't work as either a serious novel nor a crime novel. It just was neither fish nor fowl. And my publishers at the time quite rightly rejected it. And I gave them back the money, which was a very painful thing to have to do. And there was this book I'd written just sitting there, and I reread it. And I thought, I can turn this into a mystery. Excuse me. If I strengthen the mystery elements and discard any hope of it being mainstream, I could turn it into a mystery, good mystery novel. And I did. And I changed the title to Goldilocks, which the young stepdaughters in the novel called the young daughters from the former marriage called their new wife, their father's new wife. They referred to her snidely as Goldilocks, mm-hmm. who came in and ate and finally ended up in the bed, you know. It was published, and it was also published in England, where there's a long way around the mulberry bush, but I'm getting to the point, believe me. My then paperback publisher said, it's too bad we don't have a series like the 87 Precinct, which another publisher owned, because we'd like to really publish Ed McBain. Oh, incidentally, I did change the name on it to Ed McBain. It was originally an Evan Hunter novel. And I said, why don't we do a series with fairy tale and nursery rhyme titles and using the same character, Matthew Hope? And they said, sounds good to us. Let's go. And we went. And now it's 10 books long.
Tell me a little bit about the character of Matthew Hope and what kind of person he is and how you made him the personality that he is.
Yeah. He's... in the earliest book in the series, he was going through not very good marriage himself. He was having an affair, which is a bad way to start off a series character. I must tell you, a guy having an affair, many female readers, when they first read the book, thought, I don't want to have anything to do with this guy. He's cheating on his wife, which he was doing. But in the second book, he's already divorced, and he treats women in a pretty nice way. And so finally he became accepted by female readers around America. He's a modest man, a good lawyer, with an innate sense of decency, I suppose. He says one of his lines is, in a world of spectacularly handsome men, I consider myself only so-so. And he's genuinely fond of women, and I think women respond to that in the books. They respond to his, he's a good man, which is hard to find.
He, of course, you set the Matthew Hope novels in Florida. You know a little bit about that area. That area is on the Gulf Coast, I believe.
Yeah, it's the city of Colusa is loosely premised on the city of Sarasota, Florida, which is on the west coast, and which is a town of about 50,000 some odd plus. Beautiful city, white sand beaches and lovely white sand beaches, palm trees, and a resort area that attracts people mostly from the Middle West. They shoot straight down from Cleveland and where are you, and they're in the west coast of Florida. It has a Midwestern morality, I suppose, and a Midwestern sensibility, as opposed to the east coast of Florida, which draws largely from the northeast of the United States. I chose Florida as a setting. I was living there at the time anyway. We spent our summers, our winters there since 1974 until just recently. We sold the house we had.
You don't have a winter place there anymore?
No. But I go down to do research occasionally. You know, I've already done the research for the next Matthew Hope. I like the notion of murder in the sun, you know. Hitchcock once said to me, if you want to make a murder more frightening, choose a location that seems absolutely innocent and serene. And he's right. You know, you don't expect murder in the sunshine. You don't expect, it's not the big bad city where the 87th precinct is, where your life isn't worth a nickel, you know. It's a different, a slower pace and warm and leisurely, and people on sailboats drifting by, and the traffic moves at a snail's pace. You don't expect someone to be murdered there. So it's all the more shocking when it happens.
And very shocking when in Mary, of course, in the garden of a woman named, well, Mary, the discovery of the bodies of three young girls. What's particularly interesting about Mary are these courtroom scenes. I mean, they crackle with the feeling of authenticity.
Thank you.
And I think they read so well, they're as good as Scott Turow and a few other people that I've been reading.
Thank
I mean,
you.
I at least I get that. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I get that
Neither
that feeling.
Am I.
But I mean, but I watch court TV occasionally, and boy, it sounds right. So the question is, I mean, since this is your actual your first courtroom scene with Matthew Hope, how were you able to get the tone down and the feeling down so well?
With difficulty, not sure. You interviewed me when I after I wrote Lizzie.
Right.
Remember when Lizzie was published, which was. A book about Lizzie Borden, an Evan Hunter novel about Lizzie Borden. And I guess I studied and restudied some 1,200 typewritten double-spaced or triple-spaced pages of trial transcript when I was writing that book. And the law fascinated me. You know, it really fascinated the workings of American law, which are premised on, obviously, the workings of British law. And in several of the 87 precinct novels, I've had some trial scenes, but abbreviated ones, nothing to the extent of the scenes in Mary. When I began the book, I was doing work with a lawyer in New York who used to be a district attorney, and he helped me with it. And because Florida law is different from New York law, I was working with a judge, a lawyer in Florida who used to be a judge, so I could get the viewpoint of the judge. And also of the guy who used to be a DA could give me the prosecutor's notion of it. And now they were both defense lawyers, so I could get Matthew's case put together. And when I must have called these guys three or four times a day when I was writing the trial scenes. Anytime I came up against something, you know, can he say this? No. What would he object? On what grounds would he object? And, you know, we'd go through it on the phone at great length, three or four times a day, until I got it right. I think, you know, I'm not sure. It may be easy for a lawyer to write courtroom scenes. But it's not easy for a writer, just a simple old writer like me, to write courtroom scenes. So I figure if I'm going to write one, I better make it damn good.
I don't know that it's easy for a lawyer to write courtroom scenes. I mean, it's easy for a lawyer to be a lawyer, maybe, mm-hmm. or hard as the case may be. But it takes a special person to be able to put this in print. You understand that, like in a baseball game, I've been a juror a number of times, and so I've heard a lot of this testimony. And like a baseball, you know how slow it is?
Yeah.
All these pauses and gaps and sidebars.
Oh, yeah.
And you sit there as a juror. You don't know what's going on. Of course, in Mary Mary, where they go up at a sidebar, as a reader, we can hear. We know what they're talking about. But if you were to take an actual trial transcript or just watch it without being cleaned up the way without the editing that court TV does, this is long, drawn out, boring, many delays. Jurors are asked to leave the room completely, and then they come back. It's dull.
See, what I did in Mary Mary, I tried to explain every step along the way to the reader what was happening. First, I did it to the judge, explaining the way a trial works to the reader, to the jury, but really to the reader, so that the reader knows what he's looking for. He knows that when the lawyers object, he's not supposed to speculate on why they're objecting or why something was admitted and something was overruled. I explain the strategy of each of the lawyers as it goes along, so that Matthew is explaining what his opponent's strategy is, while Matthew is explaining his strategy as he goes along, so that I tried to make the reader feel privy to everything that was happening at the trial, rather than someone sitting in the jury box who was scratching his head, you know?
Well, actually, it depends. I was on a juror on a federal trial once, and it was a suit against Lloyd's of London, which had refused to pay $250,000 insurance claim for damaged furs because they alleged fraud and collusion, and they brought in all sorts of testimony, including a psychopathic witness who was arrested on a gun charge and perjured himself in the courtroom. And the nice thing about that was it was a federal trial, and the judge was very gregarious.
Uh-huh.
And so he would turn to the jury, and there were six of us, and he would explain things as we went along.
Oh, well, that must have been a wonderfully entertaining experience.
It was fascinating. I thought being on a civil case like that, I wasn't going to like it, because the drama is going to be where you have violence and all of that. But this was had every much drama as anything involving specific violence. And it did have violence in it, in fact.
Uh-huh.
The guy with the gun had actually attacked the furrier, alleging that he was involved in a conspiracy with the furrier to inflate the value of the furs, and it was proved that he was perjuring himself because we're talking about you.
Well, not
but
at
just,
all. I'm fascinated.
But
I think Americans in general are fascinated with trials and courtroom procedures.
What do you think about this case that has nothing to do with Mary Mary, but this case in New Jersey where this daycare worker, Margaret Kelly Michaels.
Yeah, I just caught a passing glimpse of that, and I don't really know what it's all about.
Oh, wow, what a miscarriage of justice she went through. Remember in the 1980s where we had state after state had these allegations of child sex abuse?
Mm-hmm.
All over the country. I mean, there were dozens of cases all over. And I thought at the time, I said, you know, there's a wave of hysteria here.
Mm-hmm.
And this poor woman was caught up in it and convicted by a judge who actually interviewed the children himself and was videotaped with the children on his knee, whispering in their ears, playing ball with them, and the jury saw all of this. This was the judge that sentenced her to 47 years in prison. And the judge would not let the defense talk to the children, and the judge permitted testimony from expert witnesses who were not expert witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I knew at the time that this woman was being railroaded. She spent 5 years in jail. They just let her out yesterday on $75,000 bail, and they may try to prosecute her again.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was a terrible miscarriage of justice, and there are a lot of heroes. There's going to be a lot written about that case in the future,
I'll
I'm
bet.
Sure.
I'll bet.
Already there's been one book. Nonfiction, I'm
Coming
sure. There's
the
already been one book out about it by a reporter covering it for a local paper there, and I read that book, and the reporter concluded that she was guilty, in her opinion. But yeah, I just mentioned that because you're right. This was a trial that I watched at the time, And just to see the way the law works is fascinating to people because there's so much drama in it.
Mm-hmm. Inherent drama. It's there, you know, it's the two gladiators in the arena fighting for the, with the lady's favor tied around their arm or on, in their helmet, you know, it's really what they're doing.
Are you putting Matthew Hope back in the courtroom in the future?
I think so. It's harder to do, obviously. It's easy to have him track down a murder suspect and bring him to justice, so to speak. It's harder to write the trial. You see, Matthew has a quaint notion of the law in terms of most lawyers we deal with nowadays. Matthew believes that if someone is guilty, he will not defend that person. He will only defend people in whom he strongly believes in their innocence. That's all he will do. So I have a nice premise there in that when Matthew takes on a case, everything looks stacked against his client, but he believes in the client, and he believes in the client's innocence and will do his best to prove that client innocent. He will not take on a case where a man comes to him and says, I killed my wife, my three children, my police dog, and my pet goldfish, and get me off with a light sentence. Matthew won't take that on.
Well, you threw me off a little bit. As I was reading Mary Mary, I reached a point where...
Careful now.
No, I'm not going to give it away. Okay. I'm not going to give it away. But where there's a digression, and I get the impression that that Mary, mm-hmm. is the defendant, is speaking, but that she has a double identity, mm-hmm. and that her evil side mm-hmm. has committed these brutal crimes.
Well,
I was convinced. I said, you know, he gave it away. He gave it away.
I very carefully, lead my readers down the garden path, but I always play pretty fair with them, I think, and in this one, maybe too fair. I like my reader to have all the information that my hero or heroine has, and sometimes even more, because very often I'll go into the head of the killer, and obviously the people, tracking down the killer can't do that. So that's one of the first rules I learned in writing. Never write a reader cheater, is what we call it in the trade. No reader cheaters. Give them all they need to know, and give them a fair opportunity to dope it out themselves.
This would be a great a movie because it's just filled with dialogue. I mean, half the work for the screenwriter is done.
I know. But then they'll take it and say, gee, this is too easy. I think I'll put my own dialogue in there.
Yeah, they do that, don't they?
Yeah. I think Tom Cruise would make a wonderful Matthew Hope, and Joan Plowright could play Mary.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't she be wonderful?
Yeah. You mentioned that you had been going, you had gone back to the Sarasota area for research. Tell me a little bit about the kinds of research and your approach to it for your various novels.
Well, I just went down, I just got back from Sarasota. I was there last month because the next Matthew Hope book is going to be called There Was a Little Girl, you know, who had a little girl, et cetera, et cetera. And it's going to have a circus background. The circus has its winter quarters mm-hmm. in Sarasota. And I was down there talking to at least half a dozen different people who were involved in the circus at one time or another, or are involved now in putting together small circuses, traveling circuses, and finding out how it worked. The little girl is going to be a little person, you know, a midget. And I'm not sure yet whether she would be, she's going to be the victim or the person Matthew is defending. I'm not sure yet.
Now, I can see that would take a great deal of research to... How do you do it?
I just started. I mean, this is just scraping the top of the iceberg. When I really get going on this, I'll read countless books on the circus. I have a man who does difficult research for me, and I'll tell him what I need, and he'll get it for me exactly, tons of stuff for me to wade through to pick out what I need.
But going there, you can actually, from a physical standpoint, create descriptions. And
see what's actually going on.
I was talking to a young writer. His name is Paul Watkins. I don't know if you're familiar with his material. He's only 28. He's written four books. He's kind of like Graham Greene. He likes to travel to the scene of all of his stories. And his last book was about, it was set in Ireland in 1923, the early fledgling days of the Irish Republican Army. But he said he had to go and see it. I mean, he had to go see the countryside. He stayed in a little house in a village there. And he said essentially it was there to confirm what he already knew, because he's writing a historical novel, and he already had written a lot of it. But he wanted to go and look at it, just to confirm it in his mind that he had done it right.
You know, you have to do that. I noticed you had Downtown on your desk there. When I was writing that book, I went down to that area of New York, the downtown area, you know, below 42nd, Little Italy, Chinatown, etc. And I took pictures of every building, every street where I was setting a scene, so that when I went back, I could remember that street, and the photograph of it would bring back to me the different things I had seen on the street, the smells in the street, etc. And it's very important to get that hands-on working knowledge of something. When I was researching the TDD, the telephone equipment for deaf people, I went to the police department where they had one and worked it so that I could see how it worked and see the calls that were coming in on it and know what it looked like and what it felt like to operate it. You know, you can't write about something intelligent unless you really know about it. Hemingway used to say, know everything there is about the subject before you write about it, and then throw 90% of it away.
When you do this and you approach somebody for help, well, what is their reaction? Are they flattered or insulted, or they don't want to take the time, or what kind of reaction do you get?
Most people love to talk about the work they do. If you sit behind a bus driver and talk to him about his job, he'll drive his bus and tell you where he started in the morning and where he has his coffee and where he breaks, when he breaks for lunch and how does he go to the bathroom, where does he go to the bathroom when he's got a shift driving a bus. Tell you anything you want to know. A diamond cutter rarely gets a call from a writer saying, how do you cut diamonds and can I come watch you? And he'll say, sure, come on. You know, people are experts on what they do and on their own lives, and they're very happy to tell me things once they know you're sincere and interested. There are some people who try to protect their backs a lot. Some bureaucracies, you'll call them and say, why do you want to know this? Who is this? What do you mean? What kind of a call is this? You know, especially in our society today where terrible things are happening all the time. But most people are I wouldn't say flattered to be asked about what they do, but pleased to tell you. It's their life. It's what they do for a living.
Well, if it's a diamond cutter, it breaks up the day a lot. I think that would be tremendously tedious, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, how would you react if someone...
But I've talked to, in Mary Mary, you know that long sequence with the dry cleaner?
Yes.
Where he testifies on the bloodstain in the dress? I spent 2 hours with a dry cleaner talking all about stains and how you get them out and how you can determine a blood stain from a berry stain or an ink stain. And he was delighted to tell me all these things, and I was writing down like crazy, you know. I never use a tape recorder because I find they don't listen. If someone is talking to me and it's on tape, I'll figure, well, I'll listen to the tape later, and I find I'm not listening to him now. Whereas if I use a pen and pencil or pen and pad or a pencil and pad while he's talking and I'm writing, I'm really listening, you know.
Then what happened when you go back to your studio? What, do you transcribe it, put it into
it's
a computer
there.
Or something?
Usually I can understand my own handwriting. Uh-huh. If it looks shaky, I'll type it immediately so I won't lose it. And if there's something I don't understand, before I leave an interview, I'll tell him, I hope you don't mind if I call you back later. When I'm doing the actual writing, I may find some things. And they're always very cooperative.
How would you react if someone were to call you and say, hey, I'd like to, I'm doing a book about a writer. I'd like to see how he does his work. Can I go and watch you work for a while?
Don't bother me, please. Get out of my seat. No, I wouldn't do that. Well, how can you watch a writer?
I know, precisely.
Watch his fingers on the keys. Watch him thinking. I'd like to come watch you think. Nobody ever thinks a writer is working. If he's just sitting there with his arms folded across his chest, looking out the window, thinking, trying to figure out what the next scene is going to be, nobody thinks he's working. They'll come in and say, honey, the guy from the electric company is here. Or, Mr. Hunter, would you please? You know, never think you're working.
Oh, man. I was divorced not too long ago, but when I was married and living here in Manhattan in an L-shaped apartment where I would sit in the dining room L portion with my typewriter, trying to work on this book that I actually did get published, 1988.
Good.
But I would sit there typing away with my two fingers, and my kid, who was young, would come home from school or wherever, and
sounds familiar.
Yeah, he would start to hassle me, and then my wife would say, "David, don't borrow Daddy while he's typing."
Typing, yeah.
Typing, and I would just have a fit. I am not typing. I am not writing.
I said,
"What are you doing? I thought you were typing." I'm not. She didn't even know I had sold a thing, you know, until I told her I sold a book. She thought I was. And then when I got a computer, she would say, "David, don't bother Daddy while he's playing with his computer."
Playing with his computer.
And she had not the no. This is the idea of somebody looks at a writer, doesn't think they're doing any work, you know,
yeah.
That they're just. Well, he's typing something, but and he's playing something with his computer, but he's not really working.
Yeah. I've had secretaries, and you know, I work in a sort of a large room, and the secretary's across the room, taking care of addressing envelopes and paying bills and stuff like that. And I've had some who will think nothing of just coming over and out of the blue. You know, where does this envelope go, or where do I file this? You know, you're sitting there working and. Feel there is no compunction about interrupting. None.
Can't you put a red flag up?
These are all former secretaries.
Can you put a red flag up?
I guess you could. Do not disturb, put a sign on my back. Mm-hmm. But the good ones know when you're deep in concentration, you know, and because sometimes when you're really into something, you really are out of it. I mean, you're out of this world. You're there. You're inside that computer someplace where there's snow on the ground and the dog sled is racing across the terrain. That's where you are. You're not in this room. You know, you're far, far away. And to get to be interrupted there is to shatter that whole image that's in your head and coming out of your fingertips onto the paper, you know, onto the screen. And it's a terrible thing when that happens because you then have to work so hard to get it back. You know, you have to move into it again. I hate when that happens.
It must be a wonderful thing to create, someone like Matthew Hope and all the people, you know, Patricia, the prosecutor,
oh,
with whom he fell in love, and all of the various people he works with, Toots and all of these other people.
Toots Kylie, yeah.
But to create a world and to populate it. And do you actually get into this? You must actually get into it. You'd have
sure.
to, in a
oh,
way,
sure.
don't you? Just lose yourself.
I knew when Matthew Hope meets Patricia Deming in... the previous book, Three Blind Mice. I knew then that this was not the end of this encounter. You know, I knew then that she was a woman with whom I could easily fall in love. You know, she doesn't exist except in my head, which is maybe why I could easily fall in love with her. After all, she's my creation, right? So I knew something was going to happen between her and Matthew Hope in the new book, and indeed it did. And I like their romance in this, and I think she's an interesting, complicated woman. You know, not just the. Piece of fluff, you know. She's not that. She's a bright, intelligent, strong woman, and I like that.
And working on a serious character like Matthew Hope gives you the chance to develop him, doesn't it? Make him age, become more mature.
And to develop his repertory company around him. It has taken 10 books to get his repertory company in place. The private detectives who work for him, the people in his office, the policeman he knows and works with when on a case, you know, the opposing district attorneys, all the repertory company is now in place. And you can't have a series that has a character who does not have his supporting players all around him. Because it's almost impossible for... it's easy for a character to carry, a single novel all alone, but not a series of novels. He cannot... possibly carry a series of novels being the sole character in it. He needs that company around him.
Well, it wouldn't be logical because when you... people know people. I mean, people are in their lives for the long term, for the most part.
Yeah.
So the next chapter, the next book, he's not going to have a whole brand new cast of characters unless, of course, he's in Fiji or someplace like that,
exactly.
You know?
Well, that's a bad mistake to do that. One of my precepts is, one of my rules, my standing rules, is never take your lead characters or characters off their own turf. I've had British publishers say, why don't you send Steve Carella to London to investigate a case for Scotland Yard? Nope. Fish out of water. Wrong move. for any lead character to go to another country or another locale. I would never.
Well, he'd go as a visitor. And,
oh yeah, to have a good time and then come home. Yeah. But not to fall into a murder there and say, oh gee, I think I'll investigate.
I'll forget Scotland Yard. I'll solve it.
Yes,
no, that
can't
doesn't,
do that.
Doesn't
and
make sense.
Nor can Matthew Hope go to Fiji, and he can come back from Fiji at the beginning of a novel and be talking about it, but he has to stay on his turf.
You know, a few years ago, you wrote the foreword to a book about how to write fiction, which was written by Scott Meredith, the late Scott Meredith. And I was thinking that with your experience and expertise, and even just sitting here at the microphone, you're telling me all of these ways, techniques. Have you ever thought about trying to put this down so that you can write a book about how to tell fledgling writers like myself?
Yeah.
Give us some help.
I've thought of doing that, and I've also thought of teaching. I think a person's life is not complete until he has passed on some of the things he knows to younger people who may not know them and make it easier for them, you know, easier to do. I had a lot of help along the way from people who became interested in me and in the writing I was doing and who expressed that interest and encouraged me to keep writing. And I try, whenever I get letters from a young writer who wants, and I was joking earlier when you said, I want to come watch you write, but I do get a lot of letters from people who want to be writers. I don't entertain reading their scripts or anything like that, because then I never have time for my own work. But I'll answer their questions and try to help them along the way toward realizing this dream of being a writer. It's a wonderful profession, and it's a highly rewarding one, and anyone who has the talent to get into it, I try to encourage, you know, and try to see that they know it's a difficult job, but a job that will bring them enormous rewards.
What about the possibility of doing an occasional writer's workshop? They have a series of them.
I was contacted by Yale University, which is fairly close to my home. You know, I live in Norwalk, Connecticut, and New Haven is very close to us. And I went up to meet with some of the people there, and I recognized what a tyrant I would be as a teacher, because I said, what I would want to do was to teach a class for a full year, and at the end of that year, my hand-picked students would have a novel that would be marketable, a viable novel that they could submit with pride to a publisher and that I would believe was a publishable novel. And then I began asking them how much time can they give me in out of class time.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, these students have other classes to take, other courses to take. And I said, I don't care about their other courses, mathematics or whatever. I care about them writing a novel. And I would want as much time, you know, I would ask for a chapter a week or whatever the traffic will bear, you know. But the reason I didn't do it was I have such a flexible lifestyle, my wife and I. When I finish a book, 2 or 3 or 4 months, or the Evan Hunter novel I'm working on now, I've been into it for 6 months now, and it'll probably be 8-10 months before it's finished. We like to go away for 2 or 3 weeks, take a break. I couldn't do that if I were locked into a class, teaching a class, because I would feel a responsibility there to the students, and, you know, I would take it seriously. And I don't think I'd be able to do that if I wanted to continue my lifestyle.
You're one of the few professional writers who doesn't have to do that. I mean, you have written so many books and successfully. Many of the writers, Tom Keneally has been fairly successful, but he's been teaching at the University of California in Irvine, and he still has to supplement his
Don,
work.
I must tell you, I consider myself extremely fortunate. I think a lot of good things happened to me in the very beginning. You know, I had written a lot of short stories and several novels, mystery novels, and some juvenile science fiction before The Blackboard Jungle. But I know writers who have written books at least as good as The Blackboard Jungle, and many who have written books, first novels I'm talking about, that were much better than The Blackboard Jungle, who did not achieve the kind of success that I did with that book that enabled me to continue writing.
I wonder how The Blackboard Jungle holds up. I know that it was reissued a few years ago in a trade paperback.
With an introduction by Stephen King.
That's right.
Very scholarly introduction. Very.
but everything has changed. I mean, these were the kids in this urban school, of course, were white for the most part.
Yeah.
And now they would be all black or Hispanic. Yeah. The urban, the environment has changed.
Yeah. There was a mix in that. In the Black Boy Jungle, well, the hero was black. You know, the lead student was black. And there were several Hispanic kids in the class.
But now it would be 100%.
I don't know if it would be dated or not. I have to look at it again.
The movie is good. I have it on the videotape.
Yeah, it's not a bad movie.
And I watched it just, well, maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah.
That was really poignant. That one scene is so moving, where the kids take the records of the one teacher and throw them across the room. I mean, that has always stood out in my mind.
We had a lawsuit on that, you know, believe it or not, when the movie came out. To refresh the listener's memory, it's a scene where they smashed it. This is the teacher's prized record collection. He brings it to school to introduce him to some of his favorite swing and jazz. And during the class, it gets out of control, and they smash all his records. They throw him around the room and smash all the records. And this is in the film as well. A disc jockey in Chicago named Daddy O'Daly sued me, MGM, Simon & Schuster, and I think maybe my mother-in-law for an accounting of profits. That means he wanted the whole ball of wax. And on the grounds that he was a disc jockey whose audience was mainly young people. He had a well-known swing and jazz collection of records. And the motion picture depicted juvenile delinquents smashing the records. As a result, he was linked to juvenile delinquency and was losing listeners. The hero of the Black Boy Jungle was named Mr. Daddy-A, and the kids called him Daddy-O. That was the link. And we won the case, needless to say, but we had to bring in jazz experts from New Orleans and Kansas City and New York City and Chicago itself to testify that Daddy-O was a common expression among jazz musicians long before this guy was born. But it shows the sort of things that you know, do come out of the woodwork occasionally.
Oh, that's incredible. And I would imagine that the publisher has a legal staff look at all of your books.
Yeah, and some publishers now have insurance, which protects the writer, which is nice, you know. Otherwise, a writer is terribly vulnerable, you know. If someone brings a $1 million suit against him, it can take all his earnings on a book just to defend the suit.
Well, Ed McMain, Evan Hunter, Mary Mary, another terrific book. Hope to read more, and no doubt we will. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That's fun.